Hello, and welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Bulpit. And this week, we're taking a look back across the series and sharing our top five practical tips for agencies and business owners. We've had some fantastic conversations throughout the show, and in this episode, we're revisiting the standout moments, the insights, the lessons, and the ideas that you can put into practice in your business right away.
Welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast from The Wow Company. If you're growing a UK business with a team of 8 to 80 people, you're in the right place. Every fortnight, we share honest conversations with brilliant business minds, exploring the realities of leadership, the challenges that come with growth, and the practical ideas that make a real difference. From purpose to profit, people to process, this is your space for fresh thinking and down-to-earth inspiration.
Our first clip comes from episode 15, where we were joined by Dr. John Finn, author of The Habit Mechanic. In this section, he explains why meaningful change starts with micro-habits, small repeatable behaviours that build real momentum over time. It's a brilliant reminder that before we chase big transformations, we need the simple, sustainable habits that our brains can stick to. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We've got to help people to understand how they learn, how they change their behaviour. And the way we describe it is we have to help people to become habit mechanics, because most of what we're thinking and doing most of the time is automatic or semi-automatic. So when I say don't think of a white elephant, you don't have to consciously think about it. It's already in your mind. But people are talking about, will AI ever become conscious? Will we create super intelligent AI, general AI that can kind of think like a human can? And many people say that, no, AI will never be conscious. But equally, many scientists would tell you that humans are not conscious. Because by the time you think you've got a conscious thought in your prefrontal cortex, in your conscious memory, it's already so polluted by your biases and your faulty belief systems and your experience that it's not actually conscious. So we have predictive brains. We are predicting. Even what you see in front of you is a prediction. So people may be able to think about just walking down a dark street and seeing a shape or a shadow and thinking it's a person. When you get a bit closer, it's actually a tree or something like that. It's because your brain is projecting, it's kind of making up what the reality is. So our vision isn't constant. It's switching on and off all the time. It looks like, it feels like we have constant vision, but we don't. So the automaticity of our brain is really important to understand when we think about AI and what AI can do, what it can't do, versus what humans can do, what humans can't do. But ultimately, yeah, the key to being healthy, happy, and at our best in the world we live in now and in the future world is actually going to be driven by how good we are at learning and adapting. So learning how to build a better sleep habit, learning how to eat well, learning how to manage stress better, equally learning how to build AI into our workflows, learning how to create a culture so that it makes it easier for people's brains to work really well so they can build these new, what I would call super habits, and get rid of the destructive habits. So we think the key, and we're starting to work with businesses on this now as they roll out their bespoke AI systems, the key is to create brain state intelligent cultures. That means that the number one priority in your organization is to help your people get brain state intelligent and to make it as easy as possible for them to balance those three brain states. Because what we actually want is the businesses that are going to win will be those that can move fastest and adapt quickest. So they will be full of people who can consistently get into high charge brain states daily. Now, what we're seeing before, I said that when people were really nailing it, they could maybe do 4 to 5 hours of high charge, high impact thinking every day. With AI, that's being extended. And what we're seeing now is you can probably do 7+ hours of high charge, high impact thinking every day.
Wow.
If you're really nailing your brain state management. So we've got, but we've got to equip people with those, with the knowledge and the skills to be able to do that. We would call it, well, helping people to become AI proof, but the process is training people to become AI edge habit mechanics is how we now frame that.
But even, so you say 4 to 5 hours of the high charge brain state activity, but we've got this cross to bear profile where most people aren't even achieving four to five hours.
Most people not even achieving one hour because they're so overwhelmed. They're busy.
But if the cornerstone is the recharge piece, as a leader of an organization, how do you mandate how people sleep or eat or spend their time otherwise?
It's very, very interesting, isn't it? Before the pandemic, some of our clients were kind of really nervous about even speaking to their people about sleep, for example. And then literally a few months later, they were asking them to work from their bedrooms, right? So I've said for a long time, the biggest asset in your organization is your people. I don't think that's correct. The biggest asset in your organization are your people's habits. In other words, their brains. And because people are different from their habits, because we all know people that are really well-intended, they're very kind and they're going to do the best and they're going to do it and they'll definitely do it, but their habits get in the way. So we've got to separate people from their automatic behavior. So if we want to help people to turn up for work more recharged, there's lots of things we can do. We've got to get the 9 action factors working for us, which I don't know if we'll have a chance to go into that today, but the first factor that I would be thinking about is giving people the knowledge and the skills, showing them how they're about their brain states, how they work, giving them tools to get them working better, including, one of the tools we've got is the diet, exercise, sleep, what we call SWAP plan, self-watch, mechanism, make a plan. So every day you've got a mechanism to give you a better chance of sleeping well, eating well, exercising properly, and so on. Getting people using the willpower story, getting people creating their future ambitious, meaningful stories. So you've got to equip people with the skills. So this is like a new language, Paul. So it's almost like me saying, I think the most important thing for a business in the AI era is that everybody can speak English. But what I'm saying is, I think the most important thing is that everybody can speak brain state intelligence. It's like training people on a new language so they understand themselves in a different way. And then we can give them the skills to take more control, but we can also create our culture, set our culture up so it cultivates more super habits and makes it easier for people to destroy more destructive habits. It's not the people that are the bottleneck to businesses getting the return on investments from AI they were promised. It's people's habits. That's the bottleneck.
Our next clip comes from episode 14, where we spoke to John Redman about how agencies can future-proof themselves by adopting a SaaS mindset. In this conversation, John explains why shifting from billable hours to recurring value models is one of the most powerful ways to reshape an agency's economics and create more predictable, scalable revenue.
It's got to be something that you've got first-hand experience or your team's got first-hand experience. Okay. Because there's a lot of tech gets built for tech's sake that ends up trying to solve a problem that's not really a problem. So people go, oh, this is cool. And also there's hundreds of people on LinkedIn and Facebook going, oh, build this, do this. I made a bazillion pounds in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And none of that's true. That's just a load of clickbait. But I think it's either got to help people save money, make more money, or help them avoid some sort of risk. So that could be, regulatory or something like that. And if it doesn't do one of those three things, mm-hmm. ideally it does more than, it does a couple of those, then you shouldn't build it. And it's got to help either your business. And often these things start, especially in agency land, they start off as an internal tool. And then you think, oh, maybe there's a thing in this. Or you build it for one client and you think, oh, well, maybe we can build.
Yeah.
And our chairman actually started he spun out a software business from an agency, ended up growing it to be massive and selling it. But he started off like that, sort of building tools for clients and then thinking, well, hang on, there's something in that. And actually that is more interesting than my agency because that's making me money whilst I'm asleep.
Yeah, nice.
And I think that's the sort of the leap you've got to make in that.
Amazing. My colleague always has this question that I think couldn't be more appropriate in this situation. So I'd love to ask you. She always says, if the idea is day one, what on earth happens on day two?
The answer to what happened when I did it is now different to what you could do now because the world's changed. So I can go into why I think now is possibly a much better time to start building software than it was 5-6 years ago.
I mean, please do, but I'd love to hear what you did as well, though.
So for us, it was all about organizing. The first thing was, can we actually connect and organize all this data, right? If we're going to build this thing that does this thing, what are the component parts? So it's literally like a whiteboard or a Miro board or whatever it is. But we were on a flip chart and a whiteboard going, how could this thing work? And we all go, oh, well, what if we could do that? And what if we could do that? And is this even... So you've got to sort of... And it is a lot of sort of desk research. Like, is this physically possible? How are people currently solving this problem? And in most businesses, the problem we're solving, they've got 3 or 4 different bits of software. They're doing a lot of manual spreadsheets, Looker Studios, etc. And there's a lot of wasted time, right? So we're trying to help people save time and help them help their clients make more money. So it's understanding the component parts. And then I suppose the other bit, which people don't often do, is are there other people already doing it, right? And that isn't a bad thing, right? So if other people are already doing it, that means there's a market. And you don't have to necessarily do it 100 times better. You've just got to do it a little bit better or a little bit faster. But if there's hundreds of people doing it, maybe it's over, it's done. But I think, and also if nobody's doing it, you're either mad or you're a genius, right? So that's the sort of, I think you've got to sort of, so there's an element of understanding the component parts of how are we going to put this thing together, but then also is like doing some desk-based market research. And now, compared to 5-6 years ago, I was sat on Google trawling around, right, how do you do this? How do you do that? Finding stuff, copying and pasting it into a spreadsheet with all these links and this, that, and the other. Whereas now I could just go onto Gemini and say, deep research, tell me how to build one of these, and it'll give you the answer. And then you could even go onto something like Replit or Lovable as a non-technical person and build a prototype. It's just, so it's quite an exciting time if you have an idea about building some software, you could literally do it, potentially have an MVP in a weekend with a few credits with a Lovable or a Replit.
Okay, next up, we're heading to episode 3 featuring Sabrina Chavans. Let's take a look at the clip.
How many agency owners are actually still doing the work? That's the next question. It's like, we talk about this all the time as agency owners, and we're like, oh, we want to take on clients that are more meaningful, but sometimes we have to do the ones that pay the bills. And I'm like, well, but what are agency owners doing in that whole process? A lot of agency owners have nothing to do with actual client work. Like, a lot of them don't at all, right? They've got account directors, they've got project managers, they've got people doing the physical work, they're not doing any of it. Some are doing some of it, some act as like a creative director or account manager sort of, liaison, and but most aren't doing the physical work. So really, for a lot of agency owners, it shouldn't affect them directly, but it will affect their team because their team's happiness is what causes the problems. So what they mean is that often the team don't like it and they moan about it, it causes internal conflict and they have to put out all those fires. And that's the thing with this. And that's what most of the time agency owners, so again, going back to why I said that when I first started, if you think about when you first start this and you're very new and you're very small, the reason why you're enjoying it often when you're very small, because you are doing the fun stuff. You're doing the creative stuff. You often start out as a graphic designer, a developer, or a marketer, or whatever, and you're doing the work that you've always loved doing. You're working on projects that you enjoy working on. That's what you did. You got stuck in, you came up with ideas, you saw it go from like this tiny little thing to this amazing campaign, and it's all you. And it was so fun. Then your clients are super grateful and you get this text message going, thank you so much. I'm so happy. I'm so proud. And you see your work and it's just wonderful. It's amazing. You grow and you grow and you grow. And you're less likely working on those projects. And all you're dealing with is the admin, chasing invoices, the bureaucracy, and dealing with every complaint that comes in. And all the internal bollocks that goes with it. That's what you're dealing with. So the reality is that you're not doing any of that fun stuff anymore. So actually, it's less actually about what projects should we be taking on. That's not as important because that affects you less than the bigger picture. And most of the time, it comes down to the fact that we haven't got real processes in place. We've overlooked certain things because we grew too quickly because there was so much focus on scaling, growing, and selling your agency because that is the biggest focus in agency world. It's all about how big you are, how quickly you're growing, and you do that regardless of what else is going on in place. And instead of doing it slowly but surely and making sure every step of the way is good and that you've got everything in place to grow, you just kind of scale. And then you get to this point where you're like, oh my God, I've done it too quickly. And then you're like, oh, scramble. And then it all becomes, you know, drama and crap that you have to deal with. And that's the reality of what an agency owner's life's really like. Whereas, you know, if you did kind of go back, think about it, because if you went back and you had someone to pay you a salary that you believed that, you know, you should be getting, and you were getting a salary and you got to choose to work on really cool projects and do the things that you really, really wanted to do, which agency owner probably wouldn't do that? Like, think about it. If you said, I'm going to give you any salary you want, like a decent, not like obviously off the scale silly, but if any decent salary you want, if I'm going to give you a six-figure salary, I'm going to give you cool projects. You get to do the physical work that you love and create amazing things. Who wouldn't do that right now? Most people would. But the thing is, they could have that as a freelancer probably. But it's like, that's why so many people are like, should I go back to freelance? Because potentially that is potentially what they want to do. But at the same time, they're toying because they do want to build up this thing. And also they spent so many years building up this thing and they would love to have a team. They'd love to have this great thing. And if it could just work right, then everything would be okay. But there's always something coming in to make it not work right and stress you out. And it's like, there's that balance. But the thing is, you're realistically, you're never going to have that ideal situation where you get to be creative, you get to be paid well, because there's always other stuff to work out. And unless you've done everything really well and you've filled in all the gaps and you've got everyone working perfectly all the time, it's just not always going to work for you. I think that's the reality to it. I think people are worried about things like the perfect clients and the perfect little bits, but there's actually, if you just slow down the growth, I think you'd have a lot fewer pain points for sure.
Our next clip takes us back to an episode we did with Blair Enns, the most influential voice on pricing in agencies and consultancies. This episode was absolutely packed with practical insights, and here Blair talks about leading with expertise rather than neediness, adopting the trusted advisor stance that earns respect and shortens the path to success. It's a simple shift, but one that can change the dynamic of every sales conversation we have. Let's take a listen.
We're talking to an audience who cringes at the S word. We don't even use the word sales to describe what we do. We use a code. We call it new business development. And I reference that in the preface of the book where when I was 22 years old, I was handed responsibility for sales at the ad agency that I was working at. But the owner of the business never used the word sales. None of us did. We called it new business development. So there's a bit of a cringe factor over the role of selling. It's rooted in a mistaken idea of what it means to sell. We think what selling is talking people into things, convincing them, persuading them, cajoling them, pitching to them. And I maintain that's not how we should think about selling. I maintain that, there's a whole new model for how you think about selling. But if you think of it this way, I said the book is written for the professional or the expert first, expert advisor or practitioner whose second job is selling. So you've got two jobs as an expert. You've got two jobs. The job that you love to do, that you're very good at, that gives you confidence, is being that expert, either advisor or practitioner. You're a consultant, or you're a designer, or a marketer. So you know how an expert should show up. David Meister wrote a book called The Trusted Advisor, right? So just that phrase, the trusted advisor, it's we're putting the client's interests first. We are, it's our job to kind of lead and advise and be there as support for them and give them the unvarnished truth, to be thoughtful in the questions we pose and the answers that we give to their questions. So we know what the persona is of the expert advisor. Now, our second job of salesperson, for that job, we draw on a bunch of stereotypes. We show up, we think we have to be brilliant in the moment. We have to have the right answer to every question. We think we have to convince, it's our job to talk people into hiring us. We think we have to pitch to them, here's why you should hire us instead of hiring somebody else. So all of these thoughts that we think this is the job of the salesperson, and it's not just us, it might even be the way we've been trained, but the others in the firm. And it's also the expectations that the client is bringing to a certain extent, because we've all been sold to by bad salespeople. We know what a bad sales experience is like. So there are these two roles where in the first role, in your first job, you're very good at it, you're competent, you know how to show up. But in your second job, you think you have to adopt an entirely different persona. And my point of view and the point of view that underpins the book is one of you is good enough. Drop all the sales cliches, drop a bunch of the tactics, which might be perfectly valid for sellers of products or transactional services, but are not valid for seller expertise. And we can come back to why that is. Drop all that stuff. You already know how to behave. Use a model for selling that allows you to bring your expert persona to the fore and just behave as you would. You don't have to be somebody different. You don't have to try to be a cliched salesperson.
Our final highlight takes us to the episode that we did with the always inspiring Nils Leonard. In this clip, Nils explains why the most memorable brands root themselves in cultural truth, not category convention, choosing to stand for a belief that genuinely moves people. It's the perfect way to round off this episode, a reminder that boldness, clarity, and conviction are still the foundations of great creative work.
Arguably, advertising as we know it has become something else. It's become a service-based industry where we sell integration and synergy and consistency and assets and content and all this other stuff. But the thing we've forgotten to sell and charge handsomely for is creativity. And I don't think creativity is dead at all. I think it's precious. I think it's the secret to Uncommon's, journey. And I guess my point was that was the thing that most people had missed. And our industry had conned itself into selling something that anybody could sell. And I think that really is just the definition of lunacy, where you remove the superpower of your industry and adopt something arguably that definitely AI, but frankly, everybody else could sell. When you ask that question in the context of brands, I don't think it's ever been easier to start a brand, but building a good one is the same as it's always been. You know, it's difficult. It requires wisdom. It requires a fight. It requires all of the stuff it's always required, I would argue. I think the tools have never been more accessible for anyone to build one. I think that's joyous. I always loved, if no one's seen it, Virgil Abloh has a website called Free Game that he created before he passed, which is just an example of him as a, Jesus, you talk about personal brand, or an example of him as an amazing human, where he basically decoded the ways for anybody to start an amazing fashion lifestyle brand, you know, and he compiles how to obtain a trademark through to how to design, how to get blanks, how to do whatever. You should look at that. So I think it's never been easier, but I think as a result, it's probably never been easier to be the same as everybody else. And I think the same radical sense of bravery and liberation applies if you're going to try and start something new, and particularly if you're going to start something that genuinely matters. I've always loved Dave Hyatt referenced Yves Chouinard, the guy from Patagonia, and he said, look, arguably the best business is the best brands, and I mean literally the very best, aren't in the business of being fast. They're in the business of being slow, you know, and we're addicted to speed. And that we have a magazine called Fast Company, and we have hustle culture, and we have all of these words and these behaviors attached to speed. But actually, brands that we're going to refer to in 50 years, you know, and are going to still be loving and adopting and talking about, they're grown over time with impact and with real intent.
That's it for this highlights episode. Thanks so much for spending the time with us. On this podcast, we get the privilege of sitting down with people who are genuinely shaping the future of business. And it's been a joy to learn from them. If you'd like to explore any of these conversations in full, all the links are waiting for you in the show notes. Until next time, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for listening to the Beautiful Business Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please remember to subscribe and leave us a review. For more advice and practical tips on what it's really like to build a beautiful business, visit our content hub at wowco.uk/hub or check out the link in the show notes.